Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Lind, the co-founder of the New American Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And he has an article at Salon.com, Final Defeat of Backlash Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you, Ian.
And you're suggesting that this just completed election, in effect, is the end of the Reagan era. In fact, in your article at Salon.com, The Final Defeat of Backlash Politics, you say, no doubt some Reaganite conservatives will continue to fight the old battles, like the Japanese soldiers who hid on Pacific Islands for decades, fighting a war that had long before been lost. Pretty, quite a graphic picture you paint there.
Well, the press has gotten this wrong by treating this as a vote for the status quo, because the Republicans' majority was returned in the House. The truth is that the Democrats won a popular majority of the vote for president, for the Senate, and for the House of Representatives. Actually, more votes were cast for Democratic members of Congress than for Republican members of Congress. The only reason there's a majority in the House of Representatives for the Republicans is that Republican state legislatures gerrymandered congressional districts after the 2010 census, permitting the Republicans to have a majority in the House, even though they received a majority of the votes. So it really is a remarkable wave election, particularly because it took place at a time when many of the economic indicators are so bad still during the recession. So it does really seem to be the end of an era and the beginning of a new one.
Well, we were talking earlier about that anomaly, not so much that the House Republicans got less votes than the House Democrats, who are in the minority, but about Karl Rove's engineered 2010 takeover of the House, the biggest donor to the Republicans, of course, being the American Petroleum Institute. And thus we have global warming denial. But one of the points that was made is that unless the Obama administration in 2014 unleash the kind of ground game and assets that they have to win this election, that they treat the 2014 election like they treated the 2012 election, then we may go back to the status quo. Would you agree that that's the challenge?
Well, sure. The Republicans, even apart from redistricting and gerrymandering, might pick up some seats in both the House and the Senate in the midterms in 2014. That tends to happen in ordinary times in midterm elections. But I think that the progressives and the Democrats can take a certain amount of confidence in the fact that in a long term, things are moving in their direction. It's not just demography, it's policy. You know, basically, the Republicans are wedded to policies that are simply anachronistic in the second and third decades of the 21st century. And that on every single front, essentially, their views are not consonant with what the public wants. They're more hawkish. They want to be more aggressive in the Middle East. The vast majority of Americans, including, I'm sure, many Republicans, do not want another war in the Middle East after Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya against Iran or intervention in Syria. On social issues, the census data shows that every generation of Americans, including white Southern working class Americans, is more liberal on social issues than their parents and grandparents. So they're losing on the long term on social issues. And finally, on economics, we'll see what happens with the fiscal cliff and the supposed grand bargain, but with every year, more and more Americans are retiring. And I think it will get harder and harder for the Republicans to achieve their goal of repealing or significantly cutting back Social Security and Medicare. So, I just don't see much of a future for the party either with its present demography or with its particular policy agenda.
Well, it does seem ironic that now the House of Representatives, which was always referred to as the People's House, and conversely the U.S. Senate was often referred to as the Money House. It seems that, not to suggest that the Senate doesn't still operate on money, but that the House is, given the contours of this debate coming up over the fiscal cliff, it's going to become increasingly apparent as the Republicans box themselves into their insistence on preserving tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, that they're really going to the mat for the millionaires and billionaires.
Well, there's a certain amount of logic to that, both on the demographic and the economic front. To begin with, senators like presidents and also like governors and mayors of big cities face electorates, particularly in the medium-sized, larger states, that look like America, with a growing Latino population, substantial Black population, a much larger group of secular people. Obviously, it varies in different regions of the country. But senators, for that very reason, tend to be more moderate and to be more sympathetic to the concerns of this emerging demographic majority in the U.S. than a member of the House elected from a 95% non-Hispanic white district need be.
Gerrymandered.
Exactly. That's a gerrymandered district. What's more, the senators, precisely because it's been referred to as a millionaire's club, a lot of the senators are rich, and a great number of them are self-financed. However, your right-wing Tea Party Republican from the gerrymandered, all non-Hispanic white district, typically refer, and this is true of Democrats as well as Republicans, it's not just the Republicans, these are kind of rotten boroughs which depend on outside money. Money from a few big coastal cities, of which New York and Wall Street are particularly important. But also for the Democrats, it's L.A. and San Francisco. So that's true in general of Congress. Members of Congress raise a lot of their money from the rich on the two coasts, not from their own constituents. And so you've got this otherwise inexplicable coalition of the white working class Southern descendants of people who voted against Wall Street with William Jennings Bryan with Wall Street, because Wall Street provides the money and the district provides the voters.
Well, it's pretty clear. I saw an interview with Michael Lind, with the head of the Tea Party, on CNN after the election, and she was absolutely not going to say that we had to tax the 2%. She kept talking.
I'm not a great fan of Patrick J. Buchanan.
Right.
I've criticized him for years, but he's a genuine right wing populist, and he made the proposal years ago that no member of Congress should be able to raise any money outside of his or her district. If you had a ban on outside of district fundraising, I think these right-wing populists would have a quite different economic agenda than they actually do.
And of course, the old joke, Michael, was that the Republicans don't just want to go back and repeal the New Deal under FDR. They actually want to go back to the other Roosevelt and repeal.
Well, of course, Romney wanted us to go back to the World War One Navy.
That's true. That's kind of close to Teddy Roosevelt. But one of the things that I found extraordinary about this election is that it was pointed out that the red and blue map of the United States that results in this polarized country where, the president was only ahead 3 million in the popular vote, even though he'd got a resounding victory in the Electoral College. It was pointed out that red and blue map is very similar to the map just before the Civil War, before Fort Sumter.
Well, this is not a new development. It's been happening for decades. If you look at U.S. history, there have always been two national parties. They've gone under different names. One is based in New England and the Great Lakes Midwest area that was settled chiefly by New Englanders. That was called the Federalist, then it was the Whig Party, then it was the Republican Party from Lincoln up until Eisenhower and Nixon. Nowadays, it's the Democratic Party. They've changed names. The other party is the Southern Party. It was based in the South with alliances among mostly white working class Irish and later Italian immigrants in the Northeast and the Midwest, which were just alliances of convenience against the dominant white Protestant group in the Northern Party. And that has been called the Jeffersonian Republicans, the Democratic Republicans, the Democrats, and of course now it's called the Republicans, confusing everybody. But if you look at maps, the continuities are there, even though the names keep flipping around. And the one time this North-South political map was blurred was the New Deal era between Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson, when because of the memory of the Depression was associated with Herbert Hoover, the Republicans, apart from Eisenhower, were pretty much out of power during the mid-20th century. And you had this unusual omnibus Democratic Party, which included Northern progressives and Southern conservatives and Midwestern populists, and that all broke down at the end of the 60s with the Civil Rights Revolution and the Cultural Revolution. So in a way, we simply reverted to the historical pattern. If you look at the red state map, you really should discount the mountain and prairie states because there are very few human beings in them. So it really is much more north-south than it is red state, blue state.
Yeah, the Dakotas are pretty much an anomaly. But it does, when you mention the Civil Rights Act of 1965, of course, a part of that is the Voting Rights Act, and now that's just gone to the Supreme Court, and we've already seen the Supreme Court overturn the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law that's had profound effects, as we can see from this election. Is it possible then that the Supreme Court will be more and more isolated as a kind of reactionary court, as it was under Roosevelt when he was trying to, when the country was trying to move forward, their job was
to... That's a real danger, because if you assume that the present Republican Party is doomed, at some point there will be a new Republican Party that will win elections again, and it will be more up-to-date and so on, but it could take a while. But essentially, when parties lose in the United States, first they lose the presidency, then they lose the Senate, and then the last thing they may lose is the House. But if you overcome this gerrymandering problem, and if that's the case, the last real right-wing Republicans in the federal government may be justices of the Supreme Court. And because of lifetime tenure, this has happened repeatedly throughout American history. So, for example, in the late 19th century, when the U.S. was challenged with the growth of large corporations and the railroads, and you had all sorts of progressive reforms and even moderate reforms, you had these elderly justices whose views of economics had been formed in the pre-industrial agrarian era of the Jacksonian period. They were just striking down laws right and left because it went against what they were taught about economics in the 1830s and 1840s, you know, half a century later. And the same thing happened in the 1930s, where you had a reactionary court kept striking down New Deal reforms, including the National Recovery Administration, because it didn't fit with the economic views of the 1890s. So I think that's a legitimate concern. You may have elderly judges as the last bastions of Reaganism in the 2020s and 2030s.
So, Michael Lind, in terms, though, of how the country might move forward, and you know, we just prior to you, we did a piece on global warming with the lead author of a report commissioned by the CIA at the National Research Council on the realities of global warming, and of course, the anomaly there is that the rest of the world notices it, and here's the United States, because of largely because the Republican Party has been captured by global warming deniers, and you know, probably funded by the American Petroleum Institute, we're essentially endangering ourselves, not to mention the planet. It's pretty extraordinary. So,
well, I think global warming is real. I think that the progressives have undercut their case by two things. For one thing, many progressives, including Al Gore, have grossly exaggerated the pace of global warming, you know, by treating things, you know, like the melting of the ice caps and the flooding of permanent flooding of cities and so on, which may take place over several hundred years as though it's something that's going to happen in the near future. Well, if you're Hollywood, you can do that. But if you're trying to alert the public and you make apocalyptic predictions that don't materialize, notwithstanding Hurricane Sandy, the point is that the entire seaboard is not underwater. And isn't going to be in the foreseeable future, then you discredit yourself, and it actually helps the deniers if you engage in too much hype. The other mistake that the progressives made was, instead of focusing on the goal, which is mitigation of global warming by reducing greenhouse gases, they fetishized certain kinds of energy, specifically solar and wind power, and delegitimized other forms of energy which can also contribute to reducing greenhouse gases, namely natural gas, which has only half of the CO2 of coal. It's not perfect, but it would be an improvement. And also nuclear energy, which emits no carbon dioxide at all. And it has a local concentrated waste problem, but it's not going to fry the earth, you know, even if it contaminates a couple of counties. So I think the progressives really need to rethink their strategy. They need to be more open to debate about different kinds of energy that can contribute to global to greenhouse gas mitigation, including nuclear and natural gas instead of coal. And they also, and finally, you know, the other mistake has been to focus entirely on mitigation rather than adaptation. But as I understand the science, even if you ended all greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, sheer inertia would continue to warm the atmosphere for generations to come. And that means that you're already going to have kind of sort of, not, forgive the pun, but baked in global warming.
Sure. But that doesn't mean
to which we're going to have to adapt. So sure. you need a simultaneous strategy of mitigation, reducing future emissions, but also of adaptation, including storm barriers around Manhattan, for example, to reduce the effects that's already kind of baked into the system.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Michael Lynn, back to your piece at Salon.com, The Final Defeat of Backlash Politics. If we are, if the Reagan era has ended and a new progressive era is about to begin, the last thing the president can do is sell out on Social Security in these negotiations over the fiscal cliff.
Well, this is a real danger because a blue majority has reelected a purple president, a president who, moreover, in my view, in many ways represents the past, not the future. That is, Obama, like Clinton, was shaped as a politician during the Reagan era. And so his instincts, like Clinton's, are that he's playing from a position of weakness and that he has to prove his centrism by going halfway with all these conservative things. Now, that probably was true for Clinton at the height of the Reagan era. So I give Clinton a certain amount of slack for this. But if Obama makes all these preemptive concessions on Social Security, on Medicare, and so on, it, notwithstanding the fact that in the long term his side is winning, then I think he really will endanger his legacy and also hurt Democrats and the national interest going forward. So that should be a cause of concern.
Well, Michael Lynn, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lynn, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed, and his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. He also has an article at Salon.com, The Final Defeat of Backlash Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMasters/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America.